You've probably heard whispers about Operation Paperclip. Maybe in passing, maybe in a podcast. Something about Nazis becoming scientists and working for us. But never like this. Not with this many receipts. Not with this many stones unturned. This isn't just another retelling. This is the version no other creator has touched. By the end of this video, you'll see how the people we beat didn't just disappear. They rebuilt us. Operation Paperclip didn't just borrow German science. It rewired America. From rockets to medicine to the human mind. And the wildest part? It's not a theory. It's declassified fact. Picture this. A quiet suburb in Ohio, 1962. A boy wakes up in a basement, wrists strapped to a cold metal table. A man in a white coat hums softly in German as he places metal discs on the kid's head. A question, a spark, pain. Not Berlin, not a camp. This is America. That man didn't sneak across the border. He was invited here, paid, protected. And when the kid screamed, someone upstairs turned up the radio to drown it out. Because in the land of the free, that sound was called progress. Now, what would that mean for you or your kid if the people who perfected cruelty got a second act right here at home? Tonight, we follow the paper trail, the secret memos that broke the law, the fake resumes that scrubbed the swastikas clean, the Disney specials that turned war criminals into TV heroes, and the government programs that kept it all buried under national security. Because if this was the shortcut that won the future, what did it cost us? Maybe we didn't just win the war. Maybe we made a deal. Real quick, before we go any further, please hit subscribe. It's free, and yeah, it makes a huge difference for the channel. All right, let's keep going. Imagine finding out the villain didn't lose. He just changed uniforms. And the people who swore to stop him helped him unpack. And that's not a movie plot. That's what actually happened. They didn't land here in handcuffs. They landed in first class, escorted off military planes, given new names and new jobs, and in some cases, standing ovations. The men who built Hitler's war machine weren't hunted. They were hired. They called it Operation Paperclip. The public never voted on it. Most didn't even know it was happening. But in secret, more than 1,600 Nazi scientists, engineers, and doctors were brought to the United States. Their records cleaned. Their war crimes buried. Literally buried under fake resumes, altered files, and new security clearances. Even the name Paperclip came from the little metal clips used to attach phony bios to their immigration forms. One army memo from 1947 admitted it plainly, quote, "We are putting out propaganda to cover up the background of these men." And this is not speculation. That's direct quote from our side. Because this wasn't just about stealing German science. It was about beating the Soviets. The Cold War was coming, and America didn't want to fall behind in rockets, weapons, or worse, mind control. So the logic was simple. If these Nazi experts could help us win, who cares what they did in the camps? Who cares how many prisoners died building their rockets? And that's the part most people never hear. This wasn't just a brain drain. This was a value shift, a moral reset. We didn't just import knowledge, we imported ethics. Or maybe we left our own behind. So if this was the cost of winning the future, where's the rule book that said it was okay? Because in the next section, you're gonna see how they made this whole thing legal. Kind of. Sort of. No, not really. But close enough for government work. While we were flying Nazis into Texas, the Soviets were doing the same thing, just colder and with worse snacks. In one night, October 22nd, 1946, the Soviet Union kicked off something called Operation Osowavakim. They didn't just take scientists. They took their labs, their families, their gear, even the filing cabinets. They packed up over 2,000 specialists and dumped them across secret military zones east of the Ural Mountains. It wasn't subtle. It was state-sponsored kidnapping. But hey, war was over, right? The new one had already started. Meanwhile, the British launched Operation Surgeon. Same idea, smaller scale. And their goal? Steal German aviation experts before the Soviets or Americans could. And over here, the US was running Operation Lusty, which stands for Luftwaffe Secret Technology. Translation? Send American teams into Germany to grab every plane, part, pilot, or piece of data that wasn't nailed down. By the time the smoke cleared, the Allies weren't just cleaning up after the war. They were fighting over the future, one German scientist at a time. And that's the part most people miss. Operation Paperclip wasn't some rogue American thing. It was just one piece of a global scramble to suck up Nazi knowledge before someone else got it first. This wasn't just about building rockets. It was about building advantage in every field imaginable. Jets, nukes, chemicals, even psychological warfare. And if you're wondering how many of this was even legal, yeah, so were a lot of other people. Which brings us to the next part of the story, where we find out who signed off and how the government turned "don't hire Nazis" into "unless they're useful." You ever notice how the government loves saying one thing out loud and doing the exact opposite in private? That's how this started. In front of the cameras, we took the moral high ground. But behind closed doors, we lit it on fire. Because in 1945, President Truman signed a public order banning Nazis from US programs. No exceptions for war criminals. No loopholes for SS officers. Just not allowed. It looked great on paper. But in the shadows, there was another paper. A classified memo called JCS 1076-6, circulated by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It basically said, yeah, we know they're Nazis, but they're useful Nazis. And that was all it took. Enter the JIOA, the Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency. They were the ones running Operation Paperclip from the inside. Their job? To get the scientists in. Just don't let anyone know who they were. So they started clipping paperclips to files that had red flags. Member of the SS? Paperclip. Investigated for war crimes? Paperclip. Developed weapons used on civilians? You guessed it. One guy's file literally said ardent Nazi, but he got cleared anyway. And if the past looked a little too dirty, they just cleaned it. Whole sections of dossiers went missing. SS membership dates were edited. Some scientists were even given coaching sessions by OSS agents on how to lie during immigration interviews. I'm not joking. The intelligence community taught Nazis how to pass background checks. Meanwhile, while these guys were getting new names and government jobs, Holocaust survivors were still stuck in displaced persons camps across Europe. Stateless, starving, forgotten. One Nazi rocket engineer gets a Pentagon ID badge. A Jewish orphan gets a cot in a tent. The system didn't fail. It rerouted itself. And nobody got punished, because everybody at the top was in on it. They built a legal maze where the only way out was through complicity. And if they could twist the rules that hard, that fast, what else could they rewrite? So coming up, meet the men who got through the gates. Their records said clean, but what they really built says otherwise. Start with this. You're in a cold army tent in 1945. The man across from you used to build weapons for Hitler. Now, you're not asking him to confess. You're asking him if he wants a job. That was the moment everything changed. The U.S. didn't just raid Nazi archives. We raided Nazi mines. And it started with Operation Overcast, the original code name, before Paperclip even existed. Back then, the official story was, we're just going to ask them questions, interrogate, debrief, that's it. But within weeks, it turned into something else. The Army Ordnance Corp started moving high-value scientists into U.S. custody. First stop, Fort Bliss, Texas, and White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico. They weren't chained up. They were escorted, fed, housed. Some even brought their families. One German engineer described it like a strange vacation, barbed wire, but with Coca-Cola and typewriters. So where do we find these guys? Well, from intel operations like Project Safe Haven and OWSLs, two programs designed to track down not just Nazi tech, but the men behind it. Safe Haven was run by the State Department and the Department of Treasury. Its job was to trace where Nazis were hiding assets, documents, and themselves. OWSLs was military intelligence, and their job? Find the scientists before the Soviets did. They weren't just after bombs and blueprints, they wanted their minds. One of the earliest targets, Dr. Hubertus Strughold, known today as the father of space medicine. Back then, he was under investigation for experiments on concentration camp victims. Still ended up with a U.S. Air Force office in the NASA plaque. And here's the thing, this wasn't some rogue op. There were internal memos openly saying, these men may be war criminals, but they are useful to the United States. Useful was the magic word. That's when Overcast officially got renamed. It became Operation Paperclip in late 1945, and the tone shifted completely. We stopped asking questions and started handing out contracts. This wasn't about justice anymore. It was about leverage. What could they build for us before they built it for someone else? And just like that, interrogations became interviews. So, coming up next, let's talk names. Because the assets we brought in are the ones who shaped everything from the moon landing to the mind control programs you were never supposed to know about. He wore a tie. He smiled for Disney. He helped launch Apollo 11. But at Dora Mittelbo, under his command, 20,000 people died building rockets. And somehow, America still calls him a hero. Wernher von Braun didn't sneak into the U.S. He was escorted, welcomed, celebrated. This was Hitler's prized rocket scientist, an SS officer. He ran the V2 rocket program, the one that flattened London and used concentration camp labor from Dora Mittelbo. But after the war, he didn't go to trial. He went to Disney. Literally, I'm not kidding. Von Braun hosted TV specials for Walt Disney, helped inspire the American space craze, and became one of NASA's founding fathers. He got a Congressional Medal of Honor. The people under him, they got worked to death in underground tunnels. Next to him was Arthur Rudolph, another Nazi rocket engineer. He helped build the Saturn V, the rocket that allegedly carried us to the moon. He also oversaw forced labor at Mittelwerk. Years later, the U.S. quietly admitted the truth. He was denaturalized in 1984 for his role in war crimes, forced to leave the country he helped put on the moon. But that came decades too late. And that's just the PR team, the ones NASA could polish. The deeper you go, the darker it gets. Here are the doctors. Let's talk about Hubertus Strughold, the so-called father of space medicine. He worked on how the human body reacts in zero gravity. He also worked at the Chow, where experiments on prisoners involved freezing, high-altitude torture, and medical horrors no one volunteered for. In 1947, a memo from the U.S. Army said there was no evidence he was involved. But by 1993, German records told a different story. Enough for the Space Medicine Association to finally strip his name from their Lifetime Achievement Award. For decades, he was the good doctor with a dark file nobody wanted to open. And he wasn't the only one. Walter Schreiber was tied to biological warfare testing and vaccine experiments in camps. He ended up in Texas, teaching military medicine, until a journalist found his past and he quietly slipped away to Argentina. And if the doctors made you uneasy, wait until you meet the ones who dealt in infection and death. Let's meet the biowarfare guys. Dr. Kurt Blohm ran Nazi Germany's bioweapons program. He tested nerve agents and plague on prisoners. At Nuremberg, he was tried for war crimes, acquitted, barely. And then the U.S. recruited him. He worked on chemical warfare for the Army and was allegedly consulted for CIA experiments involving mind control and psychoactive drugs. So let that sink in. The guy who weaponized disease for Hitler got a consulting gig with the U.S. government. Then we have Eric Traub, another German virologist, and he was the go-to guy for foot and mouth disease in animals. But during the war, he worked at the Reich Research Institute, doing virus work for the SS. He later advised the USDA's biowarfare lab on Plum Island. Yes, the same Plum Island tied to alleged Lyme disease origin theories and denied FOIA documents. Coincidence? Maybe. But those are a lot of receipts with blacked out pages. And those are just the names we know. The files that didn't go missing, the ones that weren't burned. Because we also have the ones who vanished, or kept going. Plenty of these men didn't become famous, they became useful. Some worked at aerospace contractors like Bell Helicopter and Lockheed. Others helped pioneer Cold War research at Fort Detrick and Wright-Patterson. One helped design early computer guidance systems. Another worked on weather manipulation. They didn't show up in textbooks. They showed up in payroll records. And their crimes? Forgotten. Their names? Redacted. And by the 1970s, when a few journalists started sniffing around, most Americans had already watched the moon landing, waved their little flags, and moved on. So yes, NASA got the headlines, but the chemicals, the diseases, the human tests? That's where the real secrets were buried. And that's where we're going next. Not every Nazi scientist built rockets. Some built poisons, plastics, pesticides, and their work didn't put us on the moon. It put chemicals in our food, our medicine, in our bloodstream. And most of us never knew. Let's start with Otto Ambrose, the Poison King. He was Hitler's go-to chemist, a key figure behind IG Farben, the chemical conglomerate that made everything from synthetic rubber to Zyklon B, the gas used in Auschwitz. He wasn't some faceless bureaucrat. Ambrose was there. He managed the Buna plant at Monowitz, right next to Auschwitz III, where slave laborers died building synthetic fuel plants. In 1948, he was convicted at the Nuremberg trials for mass enslavement and crimes against humanity. So how did that go? He got sentenced to 8 years, served just 3. Because in the 1950s, the US decided his brain was too valuable to stay locked up. He became a chemical consultant for German industry and allegedly for US intelligence. He was advising American corporations less than a decade after running a death camp supply chain. No reparations, no outrage, just business cards. And Ambrose wasn't some exception, he was the blueprint. The US didn't just want Nazi brains for space, they wanted formulas, toxins, human test data, anything that could give us an edge in war or in medicine. Which brings us to the biofront. Enter Fort Detrick, located in Maryland. This was the U.S. Army's biowarfare headquarters, and during the Cold War, it was pulling in anyone who had experience with non-conventional weapons. Translation, if you'd studied how gas, nerve agents, or viruses kill people, you had a shot. That included data gathered under unethical conditions, like at Dachau, where Nazis tested altitude and freezing exposure on live prisoners, or at Auschwitz, where bacterial infection studies had no anesthesia, no consent, and no survivors. Rather than destroy those records, the Allies absorbed them. Documents from Project Paperclip show that Edgewood Arsenal and Fort Detrick both used Nazi medical data to jumpstart incapacitating agent programs, basically chemical weapons that don't kill but disable. Sounds humane, right? Except these agents include nerve gas, LSD variants, and aerosolized toxins, tested later on American soldiers in secret, sprayed, dosed, observed in the name of defense. But the wildest part? None of this stayed in a lab. Because once you have a formula, someone finds a market. And here's where it gets personal. That same IG Farben, empire that Ambrose helped run, after the war, it was split into modern companies like BASF, Bayer, and Hochist. All of them major players in pharmaceuticals, pesticides, and chemical manufacturing today. Bayer, for example, eventually bought Monsanto, the company behind Roundup, the weed killer with its own cancer lawsuits, and a chemical called sarin, a deadly nerve agent Ambrose worked on for Hitler. The U.S. refined it at Edgewood, and it later inspired VX gas, one of the deadliest chemical weapons ever made. These weren't just dusty files in a cabinet. This stuff crawled into our systems, quietly, legally, profitably. In some cases, products that started as Nazi military tech ended up in your kitchen or your medicine cabinet. And that's not a metaphor, that's a supply chain. So moving Nazis into the US was one thing, but sneaking them into the bloodstream of the country? That took a whole new kind of paperwork. Let's look at how they got through the front door. So let's say you're a wanted Nazi. The Allies are closing in. A Catholic bishop hands you a Red Cross passport stamped minister. Meet Bishop Alois Houdal, Rome priest, well-connected and busy making war criminals disappear. How? With papers. Red Cross travel documents, relabeled as clergy, stamped, valid, no questions. Then the rat lines. Clergy-led escape routes, north through Denmark and Sweden, or Italy to Spain, then ships to Argentina, Brazil, and Chile. Receipts? A 1986 DOJ OSI report confirms hundreds escaped this way, including Joseph Mengele, who died in a Brazilian beach decades later. Not everyone took the long way. Some skipped the ship, because while the Vatican cleaned the names, parts of state and U.S. intel cleaned the past. Immigration was told not to dig on certain applicants headed to Fort Bliss, Wright-Patterson, Edgewood. Truman said no Nazis. JIOA said no problem. The OSS, later the CIA, took notes. And this isn't a conspiracy, it's logistics. They arrived with housing, contracts, and clearances. Let's talk where they landed and why the zip codes still matter today. Sometimes the truth doesn't hide in documents. It hides in zip codes. The cover-up moved to Texas, Alabama, and Ohio, and you can follow it on a map. First stop, Fort Bliss, El Paso. For a while, it was a halfway house for Nazi engineers. Von Braun's V2 team lived on base. Salaries, housing, even field trips. Up the road, White Sands Proving Ground. We test-fired captured V2s, the same design that bombed London, now called Research. But Bliss was just a ramp. The engine room was Redstone Arsenal, Huntsville. Von Braun's crew built U.S. missile systems there, hundreds of paperclip hires. They called it Rocket City. No one asked where the rockets came from. Meanwhile, in Dayton, Ohio, Wright-Patterson became the Archive. The Air Technical Intelligence Center held captured aircraft, blueprints, even psych profiles, hauled from ruined German labs. Rumors later tied Wright-Pat to UFO retrievers in Hangar 18. These aren't legends, they're addresses, with fence lines and budgets. And the people there didn't just build weapons, they wrote the playbook. But hardware is only half the story, because what they brought with them wasn't just technology, it was thinking, methods, and a way of seeing the world that doesn't care about lines, or laws, or what's right. Let's talk about what they kept building inside people's heads. We wrote the Nuremberg Code to say, never again. Then we said, unless we're doing it. After the war, we stood in front of the world like heroes, held trials, condemned Nazi torture labs, wrote an international rulebook that basically said, don't do science on people like they're crash test dummies. But a few years later, we started doing science on people like they were crash test dummies. Unwitting patients, soldiers, prisoners, even kids. We called it Project Bluebird, launched in 1950 under the CIA's brand new Office of Scientific Intelligence. Its mission was simple, figure out how to control human behavior. Bluebird became Artichoke, and that's when things got darker. They tried everything, barbiturates, amphetamines, truth serums, hypnosis, electroshock, sensory deprivation, trauma so deep it could split a personality. And then came the big one. In 1953, CIA Director Alan Dulles signed off on a monster, codenamed MKUltra. Run by a guy named Sidney Gottlieb, a chemist with a limp, a stutter, and the full power of a black budget. He wasn't just mixing potions, he was playing God with zero adult supervision. People lost their minds. Some never got them back. Some didn't survive. And when Congress started asking questions, CIA Director Richard Helms ordered the files destroyed. That was 1973. He didn't deny it, he lit the match. What we've got left today? Shredded memos, survivor testimony, in the parts they missed on the first burn. But here's the part no one likes to talk about. MKUltra wasn't built from scratch. We imported the methods from the camps. At Dachau, Nazi doctors put prisoners in low-pressure chambers, simulating pilot ejections by starving them of oxygen until they passed out or died. We used that data to design Air Force ejection protocols. They dunked people in ice water for hours, watching them freeze to death in the name of hyperthermia research. We applied it to cold weather survival training. They tortured people to study dissociation, how trauma fractures the mind. We used that as a framework for behavior control. And the bridge between those camps and our labs? Some of the very same doctors we brought in under Operation Paperclip. One of the most famous ones? Dr. Hubertus Strughold, nicknamed the father of space medicine. But his resume didn't start at NASA, it started at Dachau. After the war, he didn't stand trial. He stood in front of classrooms, worked with the US Air Force, helped design astronaut life support systems. We even named awards after him, until someone finally went, wait, is this the guy from the torture chamber? And yeah, it was. Because that's how the moral math worked. If the tech came from rockets, the method came from camps. And once we greenlit that pipeline, we stopped building bombs. We started building programs. Weapons, not for the battlefield, but for the brain. Because once you admit what we really did, that we brought the minds behind Auschwitz into the backrooms of US intelligence, you don't just lose the moral high ground, you lose the entire script. So what happens when the line between science and torture disappears? You get progress without conscience, discovery without humanity, and we're still living with the fallout. So eventually Congress started asking questions. Boxes started disappearing. By the late 1970s, the illusion was cracking. Whispers about hidden Nazi scientists, mind control programs, and secret files were starting to surface. So Congress did what Congress does. They opened an investigation. Cue the Office of Special Investigations. A DOJ task force created in 1979 to hunt down Nazis who had slipped into the US. What they found was much worse than what they were looking for. Because by then, the real files were already gone. Not all of them, but enough of them. In 2000, Congress passed something called the Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act. It forced US agencies to open their archives, finally, and hand over every document tied to Nazi collaboration. Over the next 6 years, the Interagency Working Group, the IWG, reviewed more than 8 million pages. Sounds like transparency, right? Except, here's what they said in their final report. Some documents were deliberately destroyed prior to review. Some were shredded decades ago. Some were accidentally lost. Some were found in boxes labeled with fake project names, buried under unrelated categories. One internal memo from the CIA outright stated, "We must avoid releasing material that reflects unfavorably on the agency." Translation, burn it, bury it, rename it, but don't let it get out. And that's where it got ugly, because the DOJ's OSI was trying to bring Nazi collaborators to justice. But the CIA? They were trying to protect the ones they hired. Former Nazis and SS-linked scientists were still collecting US government pensions. Some had citizenship. Some had powerful friends. And some were still on agency payrolls. So what happened when DOJ prosecutors requested documents? Stonewall. Stall. Obfuscate. One investigator described it like this. Quote, "It felt less like an archive and more like a crime scene where someone had cleaned up too well." Because in many cases, they didn't just hide files. They created alternate versions, redacted names, switched aliases. In one case, a Nazi officer's records were updated to show a fictional post-war employment history, complete with phony references. This wasn't a conspiracy theory. This was documented in the IWG report. It was a taxpayer-funded, line-by-line admission. Yes, we covered it up. And the wildest part? This wasn't just some rogue op buried in the Cold War. US presidents knew. Agencies coordinated. All three branches of government either looked the other way or helped build the firewall. Even when whistleblowers came forward, they were often discredited, smeared, or ignored. So, what survived? Well, a few charred memos, some court transcripts, declassified confessionals from insiders with too much guilt to keep their mouths shut. And what didn't survive? The receipts that mattered most. Because once you lose the original file, you lose the chain of accountability. And that's how it worked. If a document made you look bad, it didn't go in the archive. It went in the furnace. So, how the hell did the public go from never again to cheering for guys with SS tattoos working at NASA? That's next. And the answer is propaganda. The good kind, the kind that works. We didn't just cover up the past. We animated it and aired it during primetime. You see, after the war, America had a problem. The Soviets had nukes, they had rockets, and they were already launching satellites into space. We needed to catch up. But the guy best qualified to help us was a Nazi, Wernher von Braun, Hitler's top rocket engineer, the father of the V2 missile, a weapon that rained down on London, killing thousands of civilians. And it was built in underground tunnels using slave labor from concentration camps. Not a great look for Saturday morning TV. So, instead of hiding him, we scrubbed him. We polished his past, and then we handed him a microphone. In 1955, ABC aired a special Disney program called Man in Space. It was co-produced by Walt Disney and the US government. And front and center, Wernher von Braun, in a lab coat, smiling, explaining rocket thrust. No mention of the corpses beneath metalwork. No mention of the prisoners who died building his rockets. Just friendly animations, a likable accent, and a promise of tomorrow. 40 million Americans watched that broadcast. The White House requested copies for all military branches. Von Braun became a national science hero overnight. He even got invited back for more episodes. Magazines like Collier's ran glowing spreads of von Braun's space plans. NASA made him a household name. Textbooks called him the father of the space age. Even elementary school kids watched reels of him explaining how we'd land on the moon. The narrative wasn't subtle. We weren't just building rockets. We were building forgiveness. Because the faster you move, the more the past blurs behind you. This wasn't a cover-up. It was a rebrand. We didn't just ignore his Nazi past. We introduced him on television. We wrapped it in optimism and Tomorrowland aesthetics. And we sold it to the public as progress. Because if you can't bury the past, put a smile on it and call it science. If you've made it this far, you don't need blind belief. You need receipts. And we brought them. But first, let's pause for a second. Because if you're still watching, you're not here for bedtime stories. You're here for the truth, even when it stings. And I get it. This whole thing sounds like the kind of story people make up in comment sections. And that's why it's time to show the documents. No spin, no speculation, just the receipts. Before we flash the files, let's be honest about something. Some people think this was all worth it. That bringing these scientists over, even with their baggage, helped win the Cold War, beat the Soviets, land on the moon, allegedly, and maybe even prevent another world war. And hey, maybe they're not wrong. Maybe this was the price of progress. Maybe this was a necessary evil. Maybe we're alive today because of the ugly choices made back then. And I'll leave that up to you. But here's the hard part. Try telling that to the survivors, to the prisoners experimented on in Dachau, to the families of soldiers dosed with LSD and left broken, to the ones who weren't told, weren't warned, just used. History is not just chess pieces, it's people. And when we write history like it's a trade-off sheet, we lose what makes it matter. So, here's your paper trail. Number one. IWG final report. This is the official declassified report from the Interagency Working Group. Over 8 million pages reviewed. Confirmed, files destroyed, some still classified, direct connections to Nazi collaborators and US programs. Not a theory, not a tweet, a congressional mandate. Number two, FRUS memo approving specialists' exploitation. Foreign Relations of the United States, the FRUS memo dated in 1946. It shows the government's internal approval to exploit Nazi specialists, even those who would never be allowed to immigrate publicly. Number three, the U.S. Air Force's museum page on Operation Lusty. Operation Lusty wasn't a Cold War secret. It's listed on the Air Force's own website. We recovered Nazi aircraft, scientists, and test data, then put them to work. Number four, CIA MKUltra. The report, straight from the CIA's FOIA archives and Senate hearings, includes declassified testimony, sub-project lists, drug trial documentation, and that unforgettable name, Operation Midnight Climax. Number 5, OSI case file, Arthur Rudolph. The Office of Special Investigations investigated Rudolph for his wartime record. He wasn't tried, but he was forced to leave the country, decades after his face was printed on NASA posters. All of these are linked in the description. So don't take my word for it. Click on them. Read them. Judge for yourself. Because here's the thing. Once you read the real record, you realize the truth isn't buried. It's just ignored. It's uncomfortable. It's contradictory. And it doesn't fit into a tidy, patriotic narrative. But guess what? It happened. And it happened on paper, with signatures, with orders, with receipts. And in the next section, we stop looking at documents and start asking what this did to us, as a nation, as a people, as a memory that still lives in the bones of survivors. So let's go there. ...20,000 isn't a statistic. It's a neighborhood. So let's slow this down. Because it's easy, way too easy, to get lost in numbers. To rattle off death counts like you're reading off baseball stats. 6 million, 20,000, 500,000. And somehow your brain protects you by making it abstract. So let's change that. Let's put a name to a number. Let's take a receipt and give it a face. During the war, Nazi Germany's rocket program was headquartered at a site called Mittelbau Dora near Nordhausen. But this wasn't a lab. It was a slave camp. Tunnels were carved into the harsh mountains by hand by starving men and boys to build the V-2 rocket. That same rocket that Wernher von Braun and his team brought to America. The same rocket that would become our Saturn V. But back in Germany, that rocket was built in hell. More than 60,000 forced laborers were imprisoned at Mittelbau Dora between 1943 and 1945. Of those, over 20,000 died. Not in battle, not in bombings, but from starvation, beatings, disease, execution, or just plain collapse. Many were Polish, French, Russian, Hungarian, and Jewish civilians. And some were barely teenagers. Their job? Build the rocket, then die. One survivor, Jean Michel, a French resistance fighter, later testified, quote, "We worked 12 to 14 hours in the tunnels, in unbearable conditions. We saw comrades fall from exhaustion, never to wake up. We carried their bodies past the engineers. And those engineers? Many wore SS uniforms. Some wore white coats. A few wore both." A young Polish prisoner named Alexei Kowalski, age 16, was recorded writing to his mother, quote, "The lights stay on, the air stings the chest. I try to dream of bread." He died in February 1944. But the rocket got finished. And here's where this ledger flips. Because the men who oversaw this, they didn't face tribunals. They got pensions. They got citizenships. They were flown to White Sands, New Mexico, and told, "Build us something better." So when you hear numbers like 20,000, don't think tragedy. Think transaction. That's what this was. We called it progress, but to the ones who never came back from those tunnels, it wasn't a breakthrough. It was a bill, and America signed for the charge. So maybe we won the race, but at what cost? Let's be real. It's easy to talk about rocket launches and moon landings like they're just chapters in a history book. But behind every breakthrough was a body. Behind every success story was a grave. And that's not dramatic. It's just a fact. We didn't just bring Nazi scientists to America. We celebrated them. We put them on magazine covers. We let them teach our kids about space on TV. And all the while, the people they hurt, the prisoners, the survivors, the dead, they got forgotten. Not by accident, but by design. What do you tell a family whose father died working in an underground rocket factory, while the men in charge of that factory got a medal from NASA? What do you say to a Holocaust survivor flipping through channels and seeing the guy who ran medical experiments at Dachau smiling in a Disney documentary? Hey, sorry, but we really, really, really needed his brain. That's not justice. That's not even close. And I get it. I'm not naive. Some people will say this was all worth it, that we had to beat the Soviets, that it was the lesser evil, that it saved lives in the long run. And maybe that's true. I'm not going to judge that. You can. But that doesn't make it right. There's a difference between doing what works and doing what's right. And somewhere along the line, we stopped caring about the difference. Here's the part that really stings. We said, never again. Then we made it happen again, just under a different flag. We said we were the good guys, but when it came time to win, we hired the bad guys. We paid them, we protected them, and we told ourselves it was for the greater good. But the people who were experimented on, the people who were tortured, they didn't get a greater good. They just got left behind. Maybe we won the race, but somewhere along the way, we stopped looking in the mirror and lost our soul. This isn't ancient history. This is our legacy, and the shadow it cast, we're still living in it today. If this one hit you like it hit me, thank you for sticking with me. This was a tough topic. I'm Ralph, and this is Divergent Files. If you're still here, you're one of us now. I make these videos solo, at night, after the day job, and after my kid goes to sleep. If this kind of truth first digging matters to you, please subscribe, because the algorithm most definitely is not going to push this. Comments and shares help more than you know. And if you want to keep this work alive, patreon.com/divergentfiles, that's how we do it. So stay curious, stay grounded, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there. These investigations are powered by those who believe truth still matters. Thank you to our Patreon supporters. Join the mission at patreon.com/divergentfiles.